It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 19th of August. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Rachel English and Christopher McKevitt.
In the headlines this morning, President Barack Obama says the retaking of the strategic Mosul Dam by Iraqi and Kurdish forces with US military help is a vindication of his administration's strategy in the country. A leading retail group has said it's making losses on selling pay-as-you-go energy top-up cards in response to criticism for charging fees for the service. And scientists in Northern Ireland say they've made a significant advance in the fight against hospital superbugs. With the news in detail now, here's Brian Jennings.
US President Barack Obama has said Iraqi and Kurdish forces have taken a major step forward by recapturing the strategic Mosul Dam from the Islamic State group in northern Iraq. Mr. Obama said they had demonstrated that they could work together and would continue to receive support from American forces. He also urged Iraqi politicians to quickly overcome all divisions that had helped to strengthen the Islamist insurgency. Mr. Obama said the latest developments vindicated his administration's strategy on Iraq.
We've got a national security interest in making sure our people are protected and in making sure that a savage group that seems willing to slaughter people for no rhyme or reason other than they have not kowtowed to them, that a group like that is contained because ultimately it can pose a threat to us.
The retail group Musgrave's, owners of the Supervalue and Centra outlets, have said any of their stores selling pay-as-you-go electricity and gas cards display notices stating they charge fees for the service. Retailers say they've been making losses on the top-up transactions. This follows the revelation by the Money Advice and Budgeting Service that virtually all shops in one of Dublin's poorer suburbs are imposing a surcharge on the service, which was established to help households reduce arrears on utility bills. Our social affairs correspondent, Joe Little.
This row centres on the fastest growing sector of the energy market and the Republic's poorest people. At least 150,000 households top up energy cards several times a month, mostly in a government-backed push to reduce the rate of disconnections. An agreed percentage of each transaction goes towards reducing arrears. Electric Ireland promises it won't cost more than the standard rate. However, in May, the Money Advice and Budgeting Service found that 7 out of 9 shops in a poor Dublin suburb were imposing a 20 to 50 cent surcharge on each transaction. In spite of MABS's protests, the surcharging was continuing late last month. Airtricity described it as a completely unacceptable practice by a small minority of retailers, while Electric Ireland and Bord Gáis Energy expressed strong opposition. But Musgrave's, owners of the Supervalue and Centra brands, said any of their stores selling energy top-ups display notices stating they are charging fees for the service. They and BWG Foods say their independent retailers have been losing money on it.
Israeli and Palestinian negotiators agreed to a 24-hour extension of the ceasefire in Gaza last night. The deal was struck shortly before a 5-day truce was due to expire. Egyptian mediators in Cairo say talks on a longer-term solution would continue. There have been further clashes between demonstrators and police in Ferguson, Missouri overnight, despite the deployment of the National Guard. Police are reported to have used tear gas and stun grenades to disperse crowds, who continue to protest at the shooting dead of an unarmed black teenager by a policeman 10 days ago. The United States Justice Department has begun an independent federal criminal investigation into the fatal shooting of Michael Brown. Permanent TSB has reported an operating loss before exceptional items of €171 million for the first half of its trading year. The figure is down over 60% compared with the same time last year. The improvement was driven by a sharp reduction in impairments. Brian Finn of our business staff.
Permanent TSB will be keen to emphasise future potential with these results. One of the highlights of its report for the half year today is that the group has boosted mortgage lending 3.5-fold to €180 million, giving it a 13% market share. As for past legacies, the operating loss, before exceptional items, is down 62% on the same time last year. Impairment charges, that's the money set aside to deal with expected loan losses, were down by two-thirds to €149 million. When there stripped out, the group reported an underlying operating profit of €4 million. The number of customers in arrears of more than 90 days is falling, reflecting the general trend across the market.
Scientists in Northern Ireland claim they have made a significant advance in the fight against hospital superbugs, including those most resistant to antibiotics. They say they have developed a new antibacterial gel, which uses natural proteins to kill bacteria. Our science and technology correspondent, Will Goodbody.
When bacteria attach to surfaces, they produce a jelly-like substance called biofilm. This protects the microbes, making it next to impossible in many cases for antibiotics to attack and destroy them. As a result, such infections can grow and thrive, and when they are located around medical implants like hip replacements or catheters, often the only option is to remove the device. But scientists at Queen's University Belfast, working with researchers in the US, have developed a gel made from the building blocks of natural proteins which can target and kill hospital superbugs, including staphylococci, E. coli and Pseudomonas. Dr. Gary Laverty from Queen's said the innovative gel could provide an alternative to the painful option of having to remove infected implants. Pseudomonas can be particularly dangerous for those with weakened immune systems. In 2011 and 2012, 4 babies died in the north over 2 months after they contracted the bacteria.
Gardaí in Dublin investigating the fatal stabbing of David Sheridan, who died after being attacked at North Strand in Dublin on Sunday night, have arrested a 63-year-old man. The man was arrested this morning and is being detained at Mountjoy Garda Station under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act. Now the time is coming up to 7:08. The weather forecast, sunny spells will develop, but there will be some scattered showers also, a few of them possibly heavy. Rather cool, with highest temperatures 14 to 17 degrees.
And here again with It Says in the Papers is Valerie Cox.
Our graveyards are full of young people due to drugs. That's the devoted mum of rock icon Phil Lynott, who has blasted the drugs culture in Ireland, saying graveyards are packed with young people because of drugs. Tomorrow, writes Catherine Halloran in the Irish Daily Star, Phil Lynott would have celebrated his 65th birthday, but he died in 1986, aged just 36, from pneumonia and heart failure connected to his heroin addiction. Speaking to the Star, Phil's mother, Philomena, aged 83, said, "I always tell his fans, love the man, love the music, but for God's sake, don't love the lifestyle." She visits her son's grave almost daily and says before she leaves, "I give the headstone a kick and say, that's for breaking my heart, because he did break my heart." The main story for most papers this morning concerns the young woman who says she was refused an abortion and whose baby was delivered by caesarean section. In an interview with Kitty Holland and Ruan McCormack in the Irish Times, she told them, "They said they could not do an abortion. I said, you can leave me now to die. I don't want to live in this world anymore." She says she was initially told she could have an abortion at 24 weeks, but that this was subsequently changed. A spokeswoman for the HSE said it is important to note that a pregnancy can be terminated by way of delivery through caesarean section, as it was in this instance. That story also makes the lead for the Irish Examiner, which says the HSE is to carry out an investigation into the treatment of the woman. Abortion case, the missing 12 weeks is the Irish Independent's headline. And Eilish O'Regan asks, are doctors playing God if they refuse a pregnant and suicidal woman an abortion because the baby she's carrying is within 2 weeks of standing a better chance of survival? Doctors make medical and moral decisions every day, she says, often based on instinct rather than vague guidelines. Often the doctor is driven by their own values. But who would want to face the dilemma which these three doctors were confronted with? And John Downing in The Independent suggests that a fourth abortion referendum looms, but is unlikely before a general election. Yes, writes Fergus Finlay in The Examiner, we have to revisit the Eighth Amendment. We have to debate what we really want, write it down carefully and put it in the Constitution in place of the meaningless and perverse language that's there now. We have to do it by asking the question, what if it were my child? Helicopter plunges 1,700 feet and they survive, says the Irish Daily Mirror. Instructor John Toll and his student amazingly walked away unscathed from the emergency landing near Ringaskiddy in County Cork after the aircraft experienced problems. Both the Irish Daily Star and the Irish Sun lead with what the Star calls a hunt for a chipper killer. Charge drunks extra for A&E is the suggestion on the front of the Irish Daily Mail. And that comes from a former Fine Gael health spokesman, Dr. John Liam Toomey. However, the proposal has been dismissed as populist nonsense by medical professionals. Finally, there are many stories of students seeking accommodation close to college. But Sarika Pollock in The Times has a report that a number of UCD students will have to spend the first 2 weeks of term living in a hotel due to building works. Residents at the new student halls in the former Montrose Hotel, which was due to open its doors in September, have been offered alternative accommodation in hotels, as well as compensation of €200 a week and a year's subscription to an online music or film service. Fergal Hines, student union president at UCD, said the students are being well looked after.
Thank you very much, Valerie. The health service executive will today begin an internal inquiry into the treatment of a suicidal young woman who sought an abortion. The woman's baby was eventually delivered by caesarean section, prompting many questions about the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act, which was introduced just last year. Her case has also reignited the decades-old debate about the availability of abortion in this country. Irish Times journalist Kitty Holland has been speaking to the young woman who, for legal reasons, can't be identified. Kitty, in as much as you can, will you tell us a little about this young woman?
Yes, myself and Rue McCormick, the legal affairs editor from the Irish Times, met this young woman yesterday. She's extremely fragile, very vulnerable, and I would say that in my 18 years in journalism, I've never met someone as fragile and delicate as this young woman is. She arrived in Ireland earlier this year and had been raped in the country she had come from. She has no English. She has no money. She has very few people here. And where she is at the moment, she has no one. So she found out she was pregnant during a medical assessment when she arrived into the country and was told she was pregnant, and she immediately said that she would rather die than have this child. It was a rapist's child and that she couldn't bring this child into the world.
So what did she do then? Who did she talk to? Did she seek advice from anybody?
She was referred on then by the practitioner that she'd seen at that point to the Irish Family Planning Association, recognising that they could give her advice on her options. She had another pregnancy test, the pregnancy was reconfirmed, and she was then sent for a scan to a hospital to assess the gestational stage. She was 8 weeks and 4 weeks, 4 days pregnant, and she was told that if she wanted to go ahead and have a termination, she would have to face legal obstacles, which would have to be surmounted, which would be an exit and re-entry visa, because she wasn't free to leave the country. So she said she wanted to go ahead and do that, and the necessary forms were filled in. And as far as she understood at that point, she was going to be helped. She had a series of further meetings with the Irish Family Planning Association and counselling, and obviously asked about, you know, progress on the visa. She never saw a visa, but she was told at about 16 weeks about the costs that she was going to be facing. There's no funding for women unless it's deemed that they have to travel for an abortion by the state. There's no funding for that. So she was going to have to come up, she was told, with up to €1,500.
Money which presumably she didn't have.
Absolutely didn't have, and couldn't turn to anyone to help her raise it.
At any time did she say to anybody that she was feeling suicidal?
She told me and Ruan that she did say this at 8 weeks and 4 days, and that she continued to express these feelings throughout the counselling. And indeed at 16 weeks, when she was told about the costs and realised how absolutely trapped she was really in Ireland and that she couldn't access an abortion here, that she decided she was going to take her own life. And she described that to myself and Ruan yesterday, an attempt that was interrupted. She attempted to hang herself.
At what stage then did she make contact with a family friend?
She seems between 16 weeks and about 20 weeks, 21 weeks, to have really gone into some kind of despair and to have given up. She says she retreated to her room. She wasn't really eating or drinking and she wasn't talking to anyone. At about 21, 22 weeks, she seems to have had another go at trying to do something about her situation. And through a family friend, through family at home, she got in contact with this family friend here who's a professional. And he got some information and advised her that she needed to get herself to a GP and that she needed to set out exactly where she was at mentally, emotionally, and what she wanted. And that's where the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act seems to have then kicked in. That's where she made herself fully available, or her situation fully known to the HSE.
But by that stage, she was what, 23 or 24 weeks pregnant?
She was about 24 weeks pregnant, and the doctor, the GP, referred her to psychiatric hospital, as far as I can understand. She saw a psychiatrist in a hospital. She spent a night there and then was taken to the maternity hospital, where she was had another scan, and it was established that she was over 24 weeks pregnant at that point.
And she was also, was she at that point, assessed by the two psychiatrists and the obstetrician?
She was then, yeah, then she saw two psychiatrists, having had the scan, and that's, yes, the panel of experts was convened, and she was told that she couldn't have an abortion, and that's when she went on the hunger and thirst strike.
So, as you say, by that stage, she was plainly very, very upset, and that's when she went on the hunger and thirst strike, and that's when the courts were brought into this.
That's when the courts were brought in, and and she was advised that she needed to, if they were going to do anything for her, she needed to be stronger. And it seems that they didn't, from what she tells us, she didn't actually have to be force hydrated or force fed. She agreed to start eating and drinking herself, because I think she felt that she was going to get the abortion if she, I suppose, complied with what they needed her to do. She tells us that she was told she would have the abortion, that they were going to do the abortion. But then a few days later, she was told, actually, we have to go back to the cesarean section option, and that's the only option available to you.
And that, as we know, is what happened. Mm. How is she now?
She's, as I was saying, I mean, I've been in journalism for 18 years. I've interviewed a lot of very vulnerable, marginalised, hurt, distressed people. I've never come across someone as broken as she is.
Has she been able to see a psychiatrist over the past few weeks? Is there much support there for her?
She's seen the psychiatrist in hospital. She has, since she left hospital, she was discharged a week after the cesarean section, and she has seen psychiatrist twice since she left hospital. And she actually, when we were talking to her, she was going off to see the psychiatrist again. So she is being, I suppose, psychiatrically monitored or treated in the community. But I mean, given how fragile she is, I would wonder, you know, how safe she is in the community, to be honest.
Has she seen the baby, or what are her feelings now towards the baby?
She says she hasn't seen the baby, and I get the impression she doesn't want to. She doesn't want to think about it. During the interview, I just didn't push her on the issue of the baby. Mm-hmm. She's just too brittle, really.
You sought comments from both the HSE and the Irish Family Planning Association, who were involved with her at various stages. What have they said to you?
Yeah, I was speaking to Niall Bean yesterday, the chief executive of the IFPA. He said that they support women with on all options with information, their non-directional counselling, but that immigrant women, particularly those with restricted travel rights, are, he said, can be effectively trapped in Ireland, that they're probably among the most vulnerable cohort of women. But he said they give them every support they can, but they cannot help financially. They're legally restrained from getting involved in helping financially at all.
I know we've also been seeking a statement from them. And as far as the HSE were concerned, did they say anything particular, or was it just a matter of restating the fact that they are going to be looking at the questions
well,
raised
they
by
said,
this?
I mean, I asked about this assertion that she made, that she'd been offered an abortion initially at 24 weeks and was told she was going to be getting the abortion, and then they changed their mind. There seemed to have been some kind of change of mind. They said that her request for termination of the pregnancy was acceded to, and that it was terminated by way of cesarean section, so that there was no need to appeal. She said she was not given any option of appealing that decision.
There's an editorial in your own paper on this today, and I just want to read one particular sentence because it seems to hone in on one of the key issues at the heart of all of this. It talks about the Act, the New Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act, and it says, it's also unclear about who is obliged to pass on to the appropriate medical authorities the clearly expressed wish of a suicidal woman to have an abortion, particularly if she is vulnerable and has communication difficulties. That does seem to be one of the issues at the very heart of this,
doesn't it? Seems to really go to the heart of what happened to this little more than a girl, really. She expressed a desire for an abortion at 8 weeks and 4 days, when, and she said she was suicidal about the fact that she was pregnant, and for some reason she doesn't seem to have been heard. There seems to have been between 8, but particularly between the 16 weeks and 24 week, she fell between the gaps in some way. And is that because of she speaks really no English, or is it because that a lot of people express ideas of being suicidal when they're in a crisis pregnancy, and for some reason she wasn't heard? But she was obviously quite serious about how she felt, and quite intent on going through with it at 16 weeks.
Kitty Holland, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme.
News from Cairo seems a little positive. A further extension at Egypt's request, this one 24 hours of the 5-day ceasefire between Hamas militants in Gaza and Israel. That 5-day ceasefire scheduled to expire last night. However, the two sides, there is no agreement between them on building a more sustainable peace as of yet. But the lull in the bombings, has allowed those on the ground to properly assess the sheer scale of Gaza's destruction and the prospect of rebuilding the territory. We're joined on the line by Chris Gunness of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. He's in Jerusalem. We can speak to him now. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, anytime.
There is an enormous task ahead, assuming the conflict is inching towards a more sustainable ceasefire.
Well, you'd say inching towards a sustainable ceasefire. It's an interesting concept, because what we need is serious engagement by the peacemakers in dealing with the underlying causes of the conflict, and I mean the conflict in the very broadest sense. So yes, of course, from the position of a humanitarian organisation working on the ground, whose shelters, by the way, still have close to 250,000 people in them, whose homes, many of whose homes have been destroyed. We estimate that nearly 17,000 homes have been damaged or destroyed. So yes, we need to deal with the here and now. We need to deal with the extraordinary humanitarian crisis. I mean, there's a homelessness crisis, which if in any member state of the UN, if in Ireland, you know, suddenly 250,000 people became homeless, you know, there'd be a crisis of government, there'd be all sorts of things. But, you know, this is Gaza, and so it doesn't quite get the urgency that's needed. So yes, we need to sort out the here and now, but beyond that, we need to look at the underlying causes, because 2,000 Palestinians have been killed, more than two-thirds of them civilians, 459 children, 239 women, and of course on the Israeli side there have been deaths. So we cannot return to a situation of the status quo ante, forgive the posh expression, but you know, we can't go back to where we were before, where there are rockets, where there's a blockade, and there's a war every 2 years, where thousands of people are slaughtered in this way. It is unconscionable that the men of peace in Cairo could possibly allow this to recur.
The UN Secretary General some days ago, Ban Ki-moon, was saying, yes, sir, there is a commitment to rebuild, but we can't keep rebuilding, only to watch the place be destroyed again. What's your estimate of the cost of rebuilding Gaza, to put it back in some respects as it was prior to this 5-week conflict?
Well, we are working on answering precisely that question, and we don't yet have a figure. We know that the initial very conservative estimate is that 16,800 housing units have been destroyed or severely damaged, affecting 100,000 Palestinians. We know that whole areas, neighbourhoods have been completely flattened. We know that, you know, I've talked about that figure of nearly 17,000 housing units. The sewage system has been damaged or completely destroyed in places. The electricity grid completely gone. The power station was hit. There are, you know, just a few hours of electricity, 5 or 6 per day for the average household in Gaza. Water, the water system has been destroyed. Even before the conflict, there was 95% of all the water in Gaza was undrinkable. Millions of litres.
What's your assessment of the willingness of donor countries like our own, like Ireland in the past, to spend more money again on Gaza without a sustainable peace?
I have every sympathy for the good people of Ireland. And by the way, let me thank them. Ireland has been an incredibly generous donor towards UNRWA, our organisation. And the extraordinary humanitarian effort you've seen is in no small part thanks to the people of Ireland, whose tax dollars are being spent in this way. But, you know, does it really make sense to go out and spend more taxpayers' money on rebuilding a place where, because of the aggression of whoever you decide is to blame for this conflict, the tax dollars just get destroyed again? I mean, there was the Sharm el-Sheikh conference in 2009 after the last, or, you know, after one round of conflict in Gaza. Billions were pledged, billions were spent, and those same houses that were paid for with those billions that we went cap in hand to the international community, Irish taxpayers and others, that the money spent on those houses, I mean, what was it for? Those houses have been destroyed again. So does the world really think it's sensible to have another huge reconstruction conference, billions pledged? To answer your question, we don't yet know how many billions, but it'll be quite a few billions, are spent on rebuilding a place that's flattened again in 2 years. There has to be a political framework. There has to be, that's why I say, serious engagement with addressing the underlying causes of the conflict. Of course we have to rebuild Gaza. We can't just let people, you know, be in the streets and, you know, homeless. Of course there's a humanitarian imperative, but there's also a political imperative that goes hand in hand with that humanitarian imperative, and it is up to the people trying to get this peace together in Gaza to make sure, in Cairo, to make sure that we don't arrive at a situation after 2,000 people plus have been killed and after so many homes have been destroyed that, as T.S. Eliot said, we arrive at the place where we first started and know it for the first time. We have to prove T.S. Eliot wrong.
We will leave it there. Chris Gunness of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. 2,000 Palestinians, as you say, mainly civilians, killed in the 5 weeks of conflict, 64 Israeli soldiers and 3 civilian dead on the Israeli side also. Darren's here with the sports news.
Good morning to you, Chris. Referee Tom Connolly has defended his decision to call off last night's meeting of Bohemians and Shamrock Rovers. The official made the call just 45 minutes before kick-off. He felt the pitch at Dalymount Park was unsafe. He had an issue over a divot on one of the penalty spots. Both managers, Owen Heary and Pat Fennin, felt the match should have gone ahead. The postponement of the game could cost Bohemians thousands of euro. Steve Nalkin has been speaking to Tom Connolly about his controversial decision.
Well, there was work carried out on the pitch 3 hours before kick-off and has left the pitch in an unsafe condition for the players.
Now, when you say unsafe, there's about how many areas that are actually causing you a problem?
Like, it doesn't really matter how many areas or whatever. If any part of that pitch is unsafe, we have a duty of care to the players.
Do you think it was any better when Bohemians played Drogheda United last Friday?
Well, I didn't see the pitch on Friday night, so I'm not aware of what it was like on Friday night.
And you've decided, on the basis of health and safety alone, that the game shouldn't proceed, even though it's almost a sellout 3,000 crowd?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have the luxury of whether it's a sellout or whether it's not. There was work carried out 3 hours before kickoff that we inspected. We arrived at the ground an hour and a half before kickoff, as per protocol. We inspected the pitch 10 minutes later after checking the team colours, and we found the issues. We asked them, could stuff be done with it? I spoke personally with the groundsman, who informed me that it would take 8 days for this to bed in properly.
Oh, there you go. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about that story on the field of play. Sligo Rovers drew 1-1 with the league leaders Dundalk. Danny North put Sligo ahead from the penalty spot, but David McMillan equalised 5 minutes from time. Sligo finished the game with 10 men. Alan Keane was sent off. Cork City remained 4 points behind Dundalk in the standings following a 1-1 draw at home to Bray. St Pat's title hopes suffered a big blow. They lost 1-0 at home to Limerick. Drogheda overcame Derry City 1-0. UCD and Athlone Town played out a 1-1 draw. Chelsea met a winning start to the Premier League season last night. They came from a goal down to beat Burnley 3-1. Goals from Diego Costa, Andre Schurrle and Branislav Ivanovic sealed the win. Thibaut Courtois started in goal ahead of Petr Cech. Jose Mourinho very happy with his side's start to the season.
We played well. We conceded the early goal and we are not in trouble. We are not in panic. We go in our way and we keep our stability and we play the way we believe is the way we have to play this season with the players we have. So the players were fantastic in this mental stability they show.
The Cork County Board want Jimmy Barry Murphy to continue as senior hurling manager next season. His three-year term came to an end following Sunday's defeat to Tipperary, but the board has indicated they'd like him to extend his stay. There are three more Irish competitors in the pool this morning at the European Swimming Championships in Berlin. John Kenny previews the action, which gets underway very shortly.
No Irish in last evening's finals. Now the next set of our competitors in the pool this morning sees Brendan Hyland back in action in the heats of the men's 200 freestyle. Hyland isn't expected to advance as he's a butterfly specialist, but once again he'll use the event to add to his growing international experience. There is, however, expectation surrounding Ireland's two female swimmers here in Berlin, as both Sarika McMahon and Fiona Doyle will be in the water for the first time, and both will be in action in the heats of the women's 100 metres breaststroke. Doyle, based at the University of Calgary in Canada, is the Irish record holder for both the 100 and 200 breaststroke, and both Doyle and McMahon are expected to emerge from the heats this morning and into tonight's semi-finals. Indeed, there's a healthy growing rivalry between the pair, as McMahon, now based at Texas A&M University in the States, is clearly intent on breaking Doyle's Irish records. Doyle goes in heat 3 of 5 shortly. She's in lane 5. McMahon's in heat 4, but will be a little disadvantaged in that she goes in the outside lane, lane 0, not the lane she would have preferred.
The Paralympic Athletics European Championships get underway in Swansea today. There's an 8-strong Irish team competing. 4 Irish athletes there who won medals at the 2012 Paralympic Games in London. 2 of our London 2012 heroes, Jason Smith and Michael McKillop, are our best medal prospects here. James Nolan is the head of the Irish Paralympic Athletics.
Things have progressed sort of dramatically in Paralympic sport since London 2012. For example, Jason Smith today, in the next to him, has a Russian who's run 10.8. So anybody who knows 100 metres, when you're running 10 point anything, it's world class. I'm not going to be predicting goals just yet. Same with the middle distance races that Michael McKillop is in. We saw at the recent European Championships in Zurich what can happen in the middle distance races. We saw a lot of fallers, including our own Kieran O'Linard. So again, I'd say podium positions. We'd ideally see 2 each from Jason Smith and Michael McKillop.
Let's hope so. F1 team Toro Rosso has confirmed that 16-year-old Max Verstappen will join the team next season. The Dutch driver currently competes in Formula 3. Verstappen turns 17 next month. He'll become the youngest driver in the history of F1. The BBC's James Allen, though, feels that other drivers will have safety concerns with sharing the track with a teenager.
There's a saying in the sport, if you're good enough, you're old enough, but there has to be some sort of bottom floor to that. This time last year, he was racing go-karts, so it's a meteoric rise. He is obviously super talented. He's a former world kart champion, a European kart champion. He ticks all the boxes in terms of his credentials, but they've obviously fast-tracked him.
Now, incredible story. He'll be 17 when he steps into an F1 car next season, and he can't even drive at home in his Netherlands until he turns 18. Finally, there's racing this evening in Sligo. The action gets underway at 4:50.
Matt, Darren, thank you very much. Further unrest overnight on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, this after days of turmoil sparked by the fatal shooting of the unarmed teenager Michael Brown by a police officer. We can hear now a short exchange between a local woman and a policeman.
When they started throwing tear gas, I started running. I stayed right down there, rented our own lot right there. And I blocked myself in by a truck. And I was prowling like this by myself, me and the camera guy. And they continued to throw tear gas around me to where I could not leave. And then when I got up and started running, they was throwing rubber bullets at me, shooting them at me while I was running. He kept going. You could go right over there to the rental owner. I went by today, and all the bullets is in the wall.
You know why the curfew was there? So you know what? Because we know you're going to go home. We wanted you to go home. But we know that other 150 or 200 people, they're not going to go home. And then we're going to identify who they are. We're going to separate you from them. And that's what we're going to do today. So, sister, believe me, I'm not trying to hurt you.
BBC correspondent Ben James is on the ground in Ferguson. He's been filling me in on what's been happening over the past few hours.
Well, we've just driven away from the area where the protests have been happening over the last days. Tonight there's been no curfew enforced at midnight, so things were slightly different there to the last couple of nights. There were protesters marching around the area. They were told to keep marching and not stand still. They thought that would make it more possible for what they called violent elements to blend in with the peaceful protesters and cause trouble. So some people were saying they felt confined. They didn't want to be bound by what the police were telling them, but nevertheless people were marching around. It was tense, though. There were a couple of moments where there was a flurry of tension, a bottle or two thrown towards the line of riot police across the road, which meant the riot police went forward a little bit. It meant their numbers were bolstered. Suddenly 20 became more like 100, and there was a little standoff. It was dispersed with the help of some community leaders that were there. And as we left it, there were no people in the middle of the street.
And are the National Guard now on the streets as well?
Well, they are. They're here, but we haven't really seen them. They're not in evidence on the front line of what has been happening tonight. They are parked up not too far away, and they're ready to be called upon. We understand that part of what they might be called upon to do is to guard the police command post, but we've not really seen them. We've seen the odd military vehicle in some of the car parks that are used for the media and for the police to congregate, but really there was no sign of the National Guard, despite all the talk about their introduction to what's happening here in Ferguson.
And how have local people reacted then to this news that the National Guard was being called in?
I was speaking to someone earlier on who was taking part in one of our live programmes, talking to people about whether they would want their children to be part of the police. Obviously, trust in the police and how they relate to the local community has been a big part of this story here. It was interesting chatting to that man because he said, I wouldn't want my son or daughter to be part of the police, but when it came to the army, well, yeah, perhaps I would actually, because they've got a much better reputation. So people were pleased in that sense that they perhaps prefer the army to the police, but on the other hand, they were very much not interested in any more militarisation of this this story. People have been saying that they want the police to be the police, and military things should be left to war zones, and that's certainly what they don't want Ferguson to be.
Now, there is some evidence that the White House is going to step up its involvement here. There's talk of the US Attorney General travelling to Ferguson.
Yes, he's coming here on Wednesday, and we saw the President and pictures of the President meeting Eric Holder on TV screens earlier on. President Obama spoke after that. He talked indeed about that issue of militarisation versus policing, and talked of the need, in his view, to keep separation between the two. It also seemed, by the way, that the issue of the National Guard becoming involved is not something that had crossed the table in the Oval Office. It was very much framed as something that the state governor here had ordered and had actioned.
In the meantime, the investigation into Michael Brown's death continues. Now, yesterday we saw the results released of an autopsy that, was carried out for his family. So what happens next?
Well, that was the second of what will be three autopsies. There was an initial autopsy by the Split County Police. The second autopsy was commissioned by Michael Brown's family. It's done by somebody with decades of experience doing such work in New York, and they felt they wanted something that they felt was more independent of what the police had sanctioned around here. But also on a federal level, there will be a third autopsy to try to establish the facts of the case. And when the results of the independent family autopsy were being disseminated at a news conference, some of the people we were speaking to right on the spot close to where Michael Brown was shot dead were talking about how it's only those facts that will soothe things here, that they want to know every detail of this, want that to be the truth of what happened, and that will go some way to satisfying some of the craving for information here and calm some of the anger.
And that was Ben James of the BBC in Ferguson.
The Money Advice and Budgeting Service has said that virtually all shops in one Dublin survey, Dublin suburb rather, which it surveyed, were imposing a surcharge on electricity and gas cards. These were cards established to help households reduce arrears on utility bills and avoid disconnections. Well, Michael Cullity from MABS is with us in studio. The shops are saying that they impose this surcharge, or at least some of them who've spoken to RTE are saying they impose this surcharge. Charge 50 cent a transaction because they can't, because it's loss making.
Yeah, well, why would you enter into a contract if you are not going to be loss making? I ask you, you know, are these shopkeepers, you know, not very savvy? And so therefore you'd wonder when these contracts were being written up, if there wasn't a kind of a nod and a wink that these charges would take place.
Okay, well, let's step back a little bit and talk to us about the electricity cards and the gas cards. Their purpose was?
The purpose was, really, we were asked to advocate the putting in of these meters, mainly to stop people being disconnected. connected, gas basically.
Gas and electricity.
Gas and electricity. And so we have been promoting this, really, not alone in the urban areas, but throughout the country.
And so the idea is that a bit like a mobile phone top-up, you go to your shop with your card, it's topped up with credit, you put it into the meter, and there you go, you can heat your home or provide electricity.
Yes, but also you pay off arrears. So 30% of that top-up could be arrears. Mm. And so therefore, what you put in is 70% for your usage.
So everyone who uses it, presumably, is going to be financially a little bit more vulnerable than those perhaps who are guaranteed an income every week or every month.
Well, some people may put it in for lifestyle, but for our client base are people who are in financial difficulty, who are finding it very difficult to meet normal basic needs. And here they are. This is an extra charge on them. So here you're back to the issue of the poor paying more. And we think this is very unfair. And it needs some kind of, I would suggest, a policy solution.
I suggested 50 cent was the fee being charged. Was it more disparate than that?
It is 20 to 50 cent being charged for people who are already in a financially difficult place.
And they may top up, what, two or three times a month?
Well, they may top up more often than that, depending on their usage. And usually it's probably 10 or 20 euro that they would top up if they have that kind of money available to them. It may be less.
Well, the Musgrave Group, they operate Supervalue and Central Outlets. They've provided us with a statement. They're saying that the pay-as-you-go electricity and gas cards, they say they display notices that they charge those fees. People can take it or leave it.
Well, not really, most certainly, but like in one of the areas that we did our research, out of 9 shops, 7 were charging. So like consumers don't have a lot of choice, and really and truly, I think it's a bit rich for Musgraves, really, in a sense, because like these cards must be creating extra footfall, and you would expect that people who come in to buy a top up card would also maybe do some of their grocery shopping there. So like, really, I think there needs to be some investigation here. And also, you'd wonder, like, we feel that Unpost is the proper conduit through which these energy top-ups are that's the appropriate place for them.
So government should remove the facility, if you like, or
Well, you'd wonder what the tendering process is. And, you know, like, if the tendering process is that, okay, you know, what is the contractual arrangement between these local shops and the agents? And was the fact of a consumer having to pay,
final point,
either stated or unstated, basically.
Final point for you: the energy suppliers are not best pleased either.
No, to be fair, the energy suppliers are very upset, in fact, I would submit. So therefore, something else needs to be done about this issue.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Michael Cullity of MABS, thank you very much for coming into us.
The WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has said that he will leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he sought asylum for more than 2 years in a bid to avoid extradition. But why and when? Joining us is Joshua Rosenberg, legal commentator and journalist. Joshua, you were watching that news conference yesterday. What did you make of it?
Well, it was a very mysterious press conference. We weren't at all sure why he'd called it. Obviously, the Ecuador foreign minister was there, and I get the impression that Ecuador is getting a little bit fed up of putting up with Julian Assange. He's been in their embassy in London for more than 2 years ago, two years now. But as you say, what Julian Assange said, quoting his own spokesman rather mysteriously, is that he would be leaving the embassy soon. But then his spokesman made it clear that he wouldn't be leaving until the United Kingdom government decides to honour its obligations in relation to international agreements. Now, the UK government says it is honouring its obligations. It has an obligation to hand Julian Assange over to Sweden, where he's facing allegations of sexual assault. And if Mr. Assange is waiting for the UK government to change its mind and give him free passage to Ecuador, it sounds as if he's going to have to wait a lot longer in that embassy.
If and when he does leave, are there any other legal avenues open to him, or have they all been exhausted?
They've all been exhausted. He pointed out that the law has been changed in the United Kingdom. There are one or two restrictions on extradition, but it's quite clear, and he knows this, that they are not retrospective. They don't apply to him. They're not backdated. And so he can't take advantage of that. His case has been to the highest court in the United Kingdom, the Supreme Court, and has been rejected. He therefore has to go to to Sweden to face these allegations, and he also faces charges in London of breaching his bail conditions, which required him to stay at a particular address overnight, something he's failed to do for the past 2 years.
He hinted yesterday that there may be more from WikiLeaks, that there are further revelations to hear.
I think what was interesting about what he was saying yesterday was what he seems to know about what the United States is doing. As you know, his concern is that if he's extradited to Sweden, then once those proceedings are over, the Swedes will allow him to be extradited to the United States. Now, the Americans have not said on the record that they want him for any particular charges, but he gave a lot of information about what he thought the U.S. Justice Department was doing in terms of an investigation. They've obviously had an extra 2 years to look at his case while he's been in the embassy in London. So he does have a certain amount of information. On the other hand, I don't think he revealed anything new yesterday that he hadn't already revealed in the past.
Joshua Rosenberg, thank you for taking our call this morning.
One of the big building projects from the Celtic Tiger era, the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre near Grand Canal Dock in South Dublin, is currently on the market. It's being sold by NAMA. There has been or had been an offer of €20 million. That's a quarter of its actual build cost. New Beginning, which made that offer, said it would hold the venue as a public trust. The offer, though, was turned down. Well, this morning, Fianna Fáil has intervened. Its arts spokesman, Sean O'Farrell, says the government should not allow the theatre to be sold and the venue should be incorporated into the national arts infrastructure. Well, Sean O'Farrell is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Christopher.
Now, the theatre has a reputation for bringing in musicals and the like from the West End of London. It's a nice night out, but it's hardly a quintessentially Irish experience, is it? It's a commercial venture. Why do we want it?
Well, it's a great commercial venture and it's been hugely successful, and long may the touring,
but it's not Irish. It's not, it doesn't
But long may they continue. But what I'm saying is that if this were to be retained, because remember, it is now in national ownership, were it to be retained in national ownership, we would be in a position to develop it as a hub for successful Indigenous Irish theatre and musical projects. And that would add a new flavour to what's been happening very successfully there in recent years.
And that's a demand you're hearing, is it, on the ground from our arts community?
Yes, it is. I think our arts community should be involved. That's why I've written to the Minister for Arts and to the Minister for Finance, suggesting that he carry out a review of the intended sale, that he withdraw from the sale at present, and that he engage with agencies like the National Academy for Dramatic Arts, the National Theatre, and indeed your own RT performing groups, to see how could we take this facility and do what's been happening in London, for example, where a recent study has shown that 22 million people attended theatre events as compared with 13 million people in the last 12 months attending Premier League football.
What's your fear around the current sale process?
My fear is that it will continue to be developed as purely a commercial theatre, which is fine in its own right, but the opportunity of the current ownership by NAMA presents the state with an opportunity to use this to provide opportunities for Irish theatre projects and initiatives.
Do you fear there's a danger that if it's sold overseas, it may be more expensive for people to attend, they may cut salary costs, what have you? What is the quintessential point that you have? I mean, would a reassurance from an overseas buyer, for instance, or even a domestic commercial buyer, serve any purpose with you?
No, it's not so much a fear as to what would happen, but it's a fear of a lost opportunity. The opportunity being to develop this in a way that provides opportunities for Indigenous Irish theatre and performers, so that we take something that is successful but somewhat mundane and inject into it a distinctively Irish flavour.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Sean O'Farrell, Arts spokesperson for Fianna Fáil, thank you for joining us on the programme. It is just coming up to a minute to nine.